Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, July 5th, and this is our weekly news roundup, and we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Holly Pretzky from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and WCAI reporter Eve Zuckoff. And now a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. Kristen, information out of Canada this week is confirming what many suspected about the deaths of endangered right whales there. At least three of the six confirmed right whale deaths are the result of ship strikes, and now U.S. officials are stepping up a call for Canadian authorities to better protect the whales.
Yes, so officials from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, along with more than a dozen conservation groups, are pushing for stronger protections for the right whales in Canada after, as you mentioned, six of these critically endangered animals died in Canadian waters last month. On Monday, the results of a necropsy performed on one of the whale carcasses showed that that was a whale that was likely killed when it was hit by a ship, and that makes it the third death out of those six in June with physical signs of that kind of trauma. This necropsy was performed on the right whale Clipper, an adult female whose carcass was seen June 27th in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. Clipper was first seen by researchers in 2004. She's been spotted in Cape Cod Bay, and she got her name because her tail had been clipped off, which was actually the result of another vehicle injury prior to her first sighting. And these whales are frequent visitors to Cape Cod Bay in late winter and early spring. It's part of their migration pattern along the coast. They then follow their food northward into Canadian waters, but those sort of predictable protected feeding areas seem to have been kind of abandoned by the whales as their food moves further north, which is possibly a result of climate change. And of these six deaths last month, the two others that were related to ship strikes were the adult male Comet, who was seen drifting dead on June 25th, and a long-studied adult female named Punctuation, and she was seen drifting dead on June 20th. Both were located off of New Brunswick. And so this year's protocol to protect the whales in these two shipping lanes was to invoke a speed limit once a whale was spotted. That same protocol had been used in 2018 when no right whale deaths occurred in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And then when Comet's death happened, they did sort of respond by enacting a temporary speed limit of 10 knots for vessels 65 feet or longer in two of those shipping lanes north and south of Anticosti Island. But people are saying, you know, with the amount of whales that are being killed, and also there was another live but entangled whale that was spotted at the end of June and has yet to be seen again, that maybe something, you know, really needs to change and Canada needs to take a tougher look at some of these regulations.
So we know we've been talking about these right whales for a while, and there are somewhere around 400 of these left, and now six deaths in the last month, and them being confirmed by ship strikes suggests that something really has to change in the way that's being managed. NOAA officials, this is the U.S. officials, have stepped up a call now to Canadian officials to take this on.
Yes, so a top NOAA official said Wednesday that Canada really needs to implement comprehensive protections for these whales because the balance of the deaths in both countries sort of has tipped toward Canada, that it's happening more frequently there. Since 2017, 18 right whales have died in Canada, and that includes the deaths that occurred last month. Well, over the same period, eight have died in U.S. waters, and that includes one last year that was actually linked to snow crab gear that was used in Canada. And Chris Oliver, who's assistant administrator of NOAA Fisheries, said that with the estimated population at around 400 and actually fewer than 95 breeding females left, protecting every individual whale is really imperative. Oliver sent a letter to Fisheries and Oceans Canada and Transport Canada asking for a meeting as soon as possible to work together to strengthen those protections. But so far, he hasn't received a response. There were also 14, the Humane Society, along with 14 other national and international conservation groups, sent a letter on Wednesday to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and several other top Canadian officials. And the letter said that it was sent by some local groups as well, including the Yarmouth Port-based International Fund for Animal Welfare, the Marine Mammal Alliance of Nantucket, and the Whale and Dolphin Conservation in Plymouth. And what that letter said was that, you know, these deaths included four adult females with reproductive potential, and that the whale deaths in the Gulf of St. Lawrence alone are outstripping the number of births along the entire Atlantic coast over that same period. And really what they're worried about here is that we could be looking at the extinction of these animals.
It's a tragic story right now, and one that people are trying to understand what we can even do to impact this, especially as the whales are changing their migratory path, perhaps as a result of climate change and following that food northward and drifting into the shipping lanes in Canada.
Yes, one of the things they said is that, you know, where they're changing how they migrate and where they migrate, maybe we need to spend more time looking also at where those new patterns may be found.
We're going to talk now about an algae bloom. This is algae descending from Maine and New Hampshire, and it's posing a threat to the Cape's shellfish industry. It could be bad news for anyone who enjoys eating local shellfish.
Yes, so this is a red tide that's caused shellfish enclosures, and it's extended all the way from New Hampshire, the New Hampshire border, down to Duxbury, and it's sort of been creeping southward for more than a month now, and it's right now poised just north of Cape Cod. And this red tide algae produces a neurotoxin that can cause a condition called paralytic shellfish poisoning. And that condition can really cause anything from just tingling and numbness, drowsiness and dizziness, to vomiting, respiratory problems, or even death if enough of the shellfish are eaten. So a number of filter feeding shellfish like soft-shelled clams, blue mussels, surf clams, quahogs, bay scallops, oysters, and others accumulate this toxin in their tissues as they feed on the algae. And once the bloom crashes, there are no more red tide algae in the water, the shellfish kind of purge the toxin from their meats, and they're usually safe to eat within 3 days after the algae bloom ends.
So this is a condition that's more prevalent and more common to our north, and it's now moving down. There's this one bloom that appears to be moving down our way. Scientists are monitoring this.
Yeah, that's correct. The State Division of Marine Fisheries, along with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and the states of Maine and New Hampshire, closely monitor the concentration and progress of the algae along the coastline after they hatch from cyst fields in Maine, and then they're carried south by coastal currents and wind. This year, a wet May and June sort of wash nutrients into the sea that feed algae, and that's contributed to the significance of this bloom. As of Monday, Michael Hickey, who's the chief shellfish biologist for the Division of Marine Fisheries, said, though, it's hard to predict whether the tide will make it to Cape Cod. He said a lot of that's based on wind direction. So, you know, sort of however the wind blows could determine how this thing happens here or doesn't happen. So the last big red tide event was in 2005. That led to shellfish enclosures from Maine to Nantucket, and it really caused millions of dollars in lost summer revenue for shellfishermen and affiliated businesses.
You can imagine NOAA officials will be tracking that very closely, trying to see where that red tide comes and whether it's going to be pushed offshore or get trapped down into Cape Cod Bay. Let's talk about the town of Dennis. It is lining up to take another swing at funding its school budget. This is your beat, Kristen. It hasn't been an easy process so far, and now there's a special town meeting scheduled.
Yes, this has been sort of a long and complicated process for the school district this year. What's usually sort of a sometimes contentious, but always seems to be wrapped up process of getting their budget approved by both towns has sort of taken a different twist this year. The Dennis Board of Selectmen signed a warrant Tuesday for a special town meeting. That'll be at 7 p.m. on July 23rd at the Wixon School. And there's only one article on this warrant, and that's to approve about $16.8 million for the Dennis's share of the DY School District's 2020 fiscal year, which started on July 1st. And the school district actually is still without a budget for this year, even though the budget that's the current year. What the DY District has to do to get a budget is they propose a total budget number, and then both towns have to individually approve their share. This year, the DY District's attempt at passing its first budget failed in Dennis at the Dennis Town Meeting on May 7th. Voters at that meeting approved paying about $16.49 million owed by the town under the current regional school agreement, but they rejected paying about $469,000 more, which would have been required under a new way of dividing the budget between the two towns. So that kind of sent the DY School Committee back to the drawing board. On June 17th, they voted to keep that same total budget number. It's about $62 million, but they changed the formula that determines how much each town has to pay. And that actually, although it slightly boosts the amount owed by Yarmouth, it's going to be Dennis that actually has to pay about $311,000 more than what they originally approved, because the first time around they didn't approve the full amount that the school district asked. So this method of dividing costs has been kind of a point of contention between the towns for years. And many say that that's really really what prompted the town of Yarmouth to file a lawsuit in February that's jeopardized about $44.3 million in state reimbursement for a new $117 million regional middle school. That suit has been rejected, although it remains unclear whether Yarmouth will file an appeal. So meanwhile, the towns are still trying to figure out how they're going to divide their costs. This new method of dividing costs goes by foundation enrollment. And what foundation enrollment does is it counts students who live in Dennis or Yarmouth, but they go to a charter school or another public school district. And the DY district is actually financially responsible for those students. They're expected to pay about $3.3 million for them this year, the majority of whom live in Dennis. In years past, they haven't counted those students, so the argument is that, well, Yarmouth has been paying for Dennis's students who aren't attending DY schools. And, you know, both towns have kind of supported in the past the idea of fixing that and paying according to foundation enrollment. Dennis officials a couple weeks ago had put forward a settlement offer in the lawsuit that would use foundation enrollment to pay for schools, and Yarmouth didn't really bite on that. They wanted to take it a step further. So using foundation enrollment would charge Dennis about $311,000 over what they previously approved, but that amount is still less than what they had approved at the original meeting. If this revised budget fails in Dennis, state law then would require a district-wide meeting that would be open to voters from both towns, and at that meeting, the budget and accompanying assessments could be approved by a majority of vote. Those meetings are really rare, although the DY district has held two of them in recent years.
You mentioned the lawsuit that's out there still from Yarmouth against the school district. This is what's really holding up the potential for a new middle school to be built, a middle school that everybody seems to agree is needed for the district there.
Yes.
Explain for us a little bit what's happening there now.
So this new middle school has really been the process of getting it online and planning for it, getting the architecture going, has been happening since 2016. And the district qualified for this $44 million in state aid, which really was considered kind of a pretty amazing thing to get that much money for a school.
It's going to cost $117 million or something like that.
$117 million. Yes. But the state came back to the towns and said, you know, to build this new middle school would cost less in the long run than to repair these two aging middle schools. One is in each town. It's the Mattakese Middle School in West Yarmouth and the Nathaniel H. Wixon Middle School in Dennis. Students from both towns go to those schools, but they would be replaced by this new building. Both of those schools are about 50 years old. It would cost upwards of $40 million just to bring them in line with current building codes. I know Wixon has an asbestos problem that, isn't an issue now, but if they were to dig
is
into
it $40 million altogether or $40 million for
each? $40 million
each
upwards
school.
Of $40 million for each school. So then you look at, it would be unlikely that the towns would get that state reimbursement if they were to just go ahead and repair the schools individually, whereas if they go build this new school together that would be a regional school, they'd be looking at getting about $44 million back from the state. This lawsuit by Yarmouth, though, has held all that up because in order to gain access to this money, school officials have to sign a letter with the state authority who's giving them the money that says there's no threat of litigation related to this project whatsoever. So as long as there's the potential for the appeal, the school district officials are prevented from signing this letter. They have until the end of July to do so.
I was going to ask you, what's the timeline on this to get us there? Yeah.
So school officials have until the end of July. They were recently granted an extension. The original deadline had been in April. They were granted one extension till the end of June. And just last week, the building authority said they would have until the end of July to sign this letter. However, Yarmouth still has time to file an appeal in the lawsuit. So I think unless Yarmouth comes forward and says, hey, we're not appealing this, it may not bode so well for the new school.
So this is the month when that decision will be.
Yes, unless the school building authority agrees to delay the extension longer, then this would be the month we would know.
Meanwhile, the town of Yarmouth has a new way to track its projects, which also allows the public a better view of what's going on in town government. This is called a dashboard. Explain this for us.
Yeah, so this is an online dashboard, and what it does is it organizes project information that is intended to make it easier for staff to collaborate and for the public to understand how their tax dollars are being spent. This launched internally in October, and it went public at Yarmouth Town Meeting in May. Staff are now using it to prep for the Board of Selectmen's annual goal planning meeting on July 16th. And so the dashboard offers two separate interfaces. It has this internal side that allows staff to share project-related files and documents and status updates in a central location. Then it has this public side, which displays a color-coded breakdown of the town's goals, descriptions of all the projects that are aimed at achieving each goal, and then the real-time status update of each project. So you can look in and you can say, you know, the Bass River Bridge, or I'm sorry, not the, the Parkers River Bridge is, you know, X percent completed, or it's up to the minute as long as town staff are in putting that information in. And what staff are saying is that this has been really helpful for volunteer boards and committee members who no longer need to wait for a meeting or call town hall to find out what the latest developments on a project might be. And also now, instead of spending hours preparing weekly printed updates that would sort of filter up to department heads and town administration and to the Board of Selectmen, this new system generates those updates automatically. And that is saving the town time and money.
And you can find that on the website for the town of Yarmouth.
Yes, you can. It's right there. You go there and you just click on goals and you can find it right there in front of you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times has been Kristen Young. Kristen, thanks for coming in and joining us.
Oh, thank you, Steve.
We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Holly Pretzky at the Vineyard Gazette. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us now on the phone is Holly Pretzky at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Holly.
Morning, Steve.
Holly, food waste is an issue the island is taking seriously. You've got an article looking at the efforts to reduce food waste and some of the ways that people are helping this movement along. Tell us about this.
Yeah, in 2017, there was an island-wide organics feasibility study that found that 6,500 tons of food that was grown or processed or transported to the island was being shipped off the island. So we're actually paying to ship food waste off island, and that equates to 261 trucks of food waste. And so recently, food waste leaders have started an initiative to change that and to figure out a way to process all that waste here on the island and even reuse it, whether that means redistributing it to people if it's still good, or animals for food, or to be processed into compost.
So even as they're shipping food waste off the island, they've also been shipping compost onto the island. So
right.
At least one part of the idea is to recapture some of that.
Yeah, to make this all into one system that can be much more efficient and doesn't use the energy that it takes to ship things on and off.
Mm-hmm.
There's such a movement here to grow local food, and so the idea is to keep those nutrients, once you create the food, to keep them here on the island and put them back into the soil.
And tell us how this would work.
Well, the initiative is called the Martha's Vineyard Food Waste Initiative, and they've purchased a giant in-vessel composter, which is this machine. It's this huge rotating drum. It kind of looks like maybe the size of the back of a semi-trailer, and they have a food waste collection vehicle, and they visit local businesses, grocery stores, restaurants, collecting food waste, and then they deposit it into this rotating drum, which helps process it for a few days, and then they put it in piles at a farm on the island called Thimble Farm. And it takes about 3 months to break down, then it's processed one more time, and it's sold as compost. So this is really a pilot program, and the leaders of this initiative, their goal is to reduce food waste by half by 2030. And they're saying, you know, we need buy-in from towns, we need buy-in from residents on Martha's Vineyard, and if we work together and if we prove that this is possible, then we can be an example for other communities too.
You have a profile as well as of one couple who's really been a motivating factor behind all of this.
Yeah, Betsy and Jesse Fink are two philanthropists. They summer on the island, and they've really funded a lot of this program on the island. And they started getting into food waste when they owned a farm for about a decade. And they were delivering their food from that farm to grocery stores and to restaurants and seeing how much food those businesses were throwing away. And they started to say, well, hey, we could collect that food and we could feed it to our animals on this farm. And then through, you know, practicing that on their own and then starting to kind of talk to other people in the food waste world, they started to realize this is a really broad problem. It affects the entire country. And so they founded a think tank to try and get some solid data on exactly how much food is being wasted in the United States and what it's going to take to solve the problem. And so they came up with this food waste reduction report, and it has these pretty sweeping changes that are necessary for the whole country. And they said, okay, so now that we have this broad report that calls for billions of dollars and sweeping policy changes, let's go back to the local level and prove that change can actually be made and that it can actually be done. And so they set their sights on the vineyard for these pilot programs.
Holly Pretzky at the Vineyard Gazette. Holly, thanks for joining us this morning to talk about the food waste recovery movement on the island.
Thanks, Steve.
We are going to speak now with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, Tim. A Harwich boy injured on the beach last year has a message for people to try to prevent the same thing from happening to others. Tell us about this.
Sure. Last September, Sawyer Nicholson, who was 10 at the time, was at Red River Beach with his family, celebrating his grandfather's birthday. And the family had been using a metal fire pit for the evening. And when things wound down, they brought the fire pit to the edge of the water to put the fire out. But they didn't consider the sand underneath the fire pit. And when Sawyer ran over that location, he severely burned the bottom of both his feet on the superheated sand underneath that was underneath the fire pit. And Sawyer's mom, Diane, is a public safety dispatcher for Harwich, so she knew exactly what to do, called the rescue, and they eventually had to med flight Sawyer to Boston for treatment of the burns at the Shriners Hospital there. Now, the challenge that they had there was explaining to the medics and the doctors that he hadn't been burned by fire, that it was the superheated sand that had burned him, and that posed some complications. They had to remove the sand from the burn wound, and Sawyer ended up spending a couple weeks in the hospital because of that, and he underwent many more weeks of treatment afterwards. And ended up missing his first few weeks at middle school, which, you know, is a pretty critical time for a child. Now, Sawyer and his mom are sharing their story now because as Sawyer puts it now, he really doesn't want anyone to suffer through what he experienced. And the bottom line, they said, was if you have a fire on the beach, remember that the sand underneath the fire is getting heated up as well as whatever you're burning. And the only guarantee way to cool down that sand is by putting water on it. If you're having a fire right on the sand, if you dig a pit and build a fire inside it, don't bury the remnants of the fire when you're done. Make sure that you use plenty of water to put out both the fire and the sand underneath the fire to cool that down. If you're using a fire pit, remember that the sand underneath that is getting heated up, and you really need to take a precaution of dousing that sand pretty significantly with water to make sure that it cools down. And Sawyer's mom hopes that these safety tips can be included in a brochure that local fire and park departments who issue beach permits can hand out with those permits.
Mm. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
We are going to go now to Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Morning, Steve. Happy post-4th of July.
Here we are. We've got a beautiful weekend ahead of us. It's nice to look forward to. Casey, Provincetown is changing its approach to how it provides some help to people with mental health and substance abuse issues. And this has to do with their Navigator program, which we've actually talked about in the past on the Roundup as it touched on other stories.
Yes, exactly. In 1995, Provincetown created a mental health and substance abuse grant for $95,000. And this would be a contracted service that would go to a different agency that would help people who are sort of hard to reach in this Outer Cape area where there's very few treatment in general, and particularly for mental health and substance abuse. And these are often co-occurring disorders that require a lot more patient advocacy than just making a doctor's appointment. So the first grant in 2015 went to Outer Cape Health Associates, which created a model of care, as you said, called the Navigator Program. And as the name implies, the Navigator helps people navigate the frayed social service safety net out here, including filling out forms, finding the proper agencies, keeping on top of all the paperwork. There's just so much more required than making a doctor's appointment. And that's what the Navigator program was set out to do, kind of work with people directly to get them where they need to be. So one of the important tasks that Outer Cape Health Services and the Navigator program did for the town was provide sort of semi-annual, twice a year, biannual reports to the selectmen on what they were seeing out there. And what they kept coming back and saying every time they spoke was that housing was just as big a problem as mental health and substance abuse. In 2016, they said that one-third of their clients reported getting difficulty finding an affordable, mm-hmm. stable place to live. And in 2018, they said the most severe needs are mental health, substance abuse, and safe, affordable housing. So, and they said all three are interrelated. Anyway, 3 years later, after hearing this, the town put out the grant again, and instead of giving it to Outer Cape Health Services, they are now giving the $95,000 a year to the Homeless Prevention Council as a way to more directly to help the homelessness problem here.
And tell us, what is the Homeless Prevention Council looking, what's their program going to look like that's different?
Well, it's different from the Navigator program entirely. It's just it's trying to help people get housing, essentially. And the agency has been doing this work since 1991 in Provincetown part-time. They have a social worker in P-Town twice a week part-time. And this will allow a social worker to be in Provincetown full-time, including weekends and different hours, so that they can, again, trying to work with a more vulnerable population, but with their expertise is finding them places to live. And so that's what they're going to be focused on, rather than the Navigator program, which was more looking at, okay, what do you need? What kind of wraparound services can we give you to help you with all of your different issues? This is just, okay, you need housing first, and then we'll find out what else, I guess the point is nothing can really be solved until people are in a stable place to live.
And when does the program switch over now?
It's right now they're doing a warm handoff, so that the Navigator staff is working directly with the staff at the Homeless Prevention Council to introduce the clients and do that, so they're not just left scrambling. They'll have that warm handoff so that on August 1st, when a full-time social worker, or I'm not sure if it's a social worker licensed, but somebody from the Homeless Prevention Council is supposed to begin in Provincetown on August 1st. And that's when the program officially gets started.
Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thank you for joining us this morning.
Okay, thank you. Have a great day.
And now we're going to speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us, George. Let's start with an update on the strike by full-time drivers at the Vineyard Transportation Authority. Can you tell us where we are right now with that?
Yeah, so they're still striking. There hasn't been a lot of movement in terms of negotiations. There was a bit of excitement on Wednesday where some of the strikers on the picket line decided to move up to Five Corners. And folks who aren't familiar, Five Corners is one of the busiest intersections on the island, and it is extremely busy this time of year with the influx of people. And so there was a scanner call from one of the traffic officers saying that they were causing a scene, and she sounded pretty frantic. And the police went down there, and the picketers decided to go back to the Vineyard Haven terminal on their own. But yeah, there was it was causing quite a scene. But the strikers said that's their intent. They want people to know what's going on. You know, it's a little bit more difficult for this union than, say, Stop and Shop, where they have so many bus stops on the island. You can actually flag down a bus, so you don't even have to be at a stop. So difficult for them to get their message out in a lot of different places. So one of the things they tried to do is go to the busiest intersection in town. But this has lingered through the holiday. The VTA tells us that they were able to get all of the routes covered for 4th of July, which they did with substitute drivers, seasonal drivers, and some of their own management.
And when do they meet with mediators again? Is there any sense of how this moves forward?
Well, they did meet earlier this week with a mediator. They met for 7 hours. The problem is they can't get the parent company of the bus drivers back to the table. So that's where it is. It's at an impasse at this point until they can get them back.
George, you have another story in the paper. This is about the island community rallying around a young man who suffered a traumatic brain injury. Such a strong story. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so this is about Isaac Higgins, and he's a 21-year-old. He was on the roof of a moving vehicle and fell off, and that's how he suffered the injury. We don't know a lot of details about why, the circumstances behind that, but our reporter Lucas Storrs started to see this trend on Facebook where people were just putting someone's eyes as their profile picture. So he started asking some questions about that, and that was for Isaac Higgins, who was injured in this tragic way. And he reached out to the family, and they said that they started the trend. The idea is that they want to see him open his eyes again, and they're hoping the community will pray for him and help him through this period. They also have set up a GoFundMe page because, as you might imagine, you know, being airlifted to Boston and being in intensive care and critical but stable condition, he's got a lot of medical bills, and his family has a lot of medical bills and other bills as well. So this is a story about the island community rallying around Isaac, which Martha's Vineyard does so often, rally around, you know, people who are in these types of situations, and Isaac is no different. So he's in our thoughts as well.
That is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Steve. Have a good weekend.
You too. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll check in with news from the State House in Boston. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to update you now with action up at the State House in Boston. It's been a slow week on Beacon Hill, but that doesn't mean that lawmakers use the time to finish work on some pressing issues. WCAI's Catherine Ident caught up with our State House reporter Mike Dean before the halls of Beacon Hill emptied out for the holiday.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
Mike, let's start with the state budget. It is now officially late. July 1st was Monday, and that was also the start of the fiscal year. Massachusetts, once again, one of the last states in the country to get a budget for the fiscal year. Remind us, what's the holdup?
Well, here's the thing. We don't know what the holdup is because these budget negotiators between the House and the Senate, they don't disclose what the problems are. They're in a six-person, you know, closed, confidential negotiation over this, and that's it. That's all they'll tell us. They won't say, oh, we, you know, spent a long time arguing about this or that, because just as is routine for them to not disclose what those differences are. Another thing to point out is that no one, even this week, now the budget's late, no one in the State House really seems all that upset about the fact that we don't have a permanent budget. The legislature passed a budget for the month of July, so, I mean, there is something in place right now, but it is not the fiscal 2020 budget that everyone expected. This is the ninth year in a row that lawmakers have blown that deadline, so it's almost kind of becoming normal that that deadline is missed. And so, you know, if you miss a deadline for a decade, is it really a deadline? The governor said, you know, on Monday that he would prefer to have it on time, you know, on his desk for him to sign, but he wants it to be done right. So if it's a question of, you know, a faulty or flawed budget versus a late one, most everyone agrees that they'll take the late one. So I would say, you know, they're probably wrangling differences between the House and Senate over things like funding for education, UMass tuition. The Senate had a rather kind of ambitious freeze to UMass tuition in their budget bill that evidently might be holding things up on the House, and prescription drug prices. They also disagreed on that. But I would say after the holiday, check back in, and they should have some kind of compromise.
So there's no concern that they're going to have to make a provisional budget for future months. They've just needed to put aside some money to cover expenses for the month of July.
Correct. It's called a 1/12th budget. It was about $3 billion. Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido signed that last week when Governor Baker was out of town in England. And that is seen as satisfactory for now. If they have to do the same thing for the month of August, if it goes into that, then we really have some trouble. And there definitely is something wrong with those budget negotiations if this goes into August.
I want to look at another bill that we've talked about a little bit, and that is that lawmakers are trying to pass a bill that would help out organized labor. Has there been any progress with that?
Yeah, both branches have now passed what's kind of called the Janus Fix Bill. It is a response to the Supreme Court's Janus decision that they ruled last year that said that labor unions, public sector labor unions, cannot charge for non-members. They cannot charge dues unless if someone is, you know, opting out of union membership. What this bill would do is it would let them charge for legal fees that the union does on behalf of those non-members, things like arbitration, collective bargaining, things like that, where there is a financial benefit to those non-members. It would let the union charge for those. And that's the agreement. Everyone seems to think that that is a fair thing to do, everyone being, you know, Democratic leaders and Governor Baker. Baker, though, he is concerned about the provision of the bill that would grant union leaders the home contact information, home address, etc., of these non-members. He thinks that's a privacy issue. He's been fairly vocal about not liking that part of the bill, and he very well may send it back to the legislature when it gets to him. We expected that to be this week or even last week, but lawmakers are really taking their time slow walking this one to Baker's desk, so that's something to look for really towards the middle or end of July.
I guess we could say safely that there's not exactly a sense of urgency in this legislative session.
It really doesn't seem like it. There is. And even when we're dealing with some of the most major issues that the legislature has had to tackle the last few years, they seem to all be coming in this, you know, this phrasing of later on in the session or before the end of the session. That is something when we talk about K through 12, you know, education funding for districts, how the funding formula is going to be rewritten, what taxes may need to be increased to pay for new funding for K through 12, what taxes may need to be increased to pay for transportation improvements, additional funding from the legislature for the MBTA, for highways, for regional transportation systems, you know, the bus systems around the state. These are all huge, huge issues that lawmakers keep saying is going to get done before the end of the session. It means next summer. So, you know, I wouldn't be holding your breath if you're expecting lawmakers to tackle any of these big things, like you say, with any kind of sense of urgency right now.
Switching to other news, the governor was overseas a little earlier. What was he doing over there? He was in London?
Yeah, the governor went to London ostensibly to speak at an offshore wind conference, but the joke is that around here is that he went to see the Red Sox get creamed by the Yankees in
yeah,
that series
pretty.
That they had in London. No, but no, the governor was actually, he was the keynote speaker at an offshore wind conference, and really kind of talking about the New England and Massachusetts offshore wind market and clean energy tech, the sector that's really expanding in Massachusetts. And you know, Baker spoke with members of Parliament. Like I said, he was the keynote at that conference, so which I believe was, you know, for most of the European market as well. And he, you know, also did get a chance to go to the Red Sox game.
A little perk, even if it was a disappointing outcome there. I want to switch now to another story that's not necessarily related to Beacon Hill per se, although there has been some lawmakers chiming in, and that is big news out of the Registry of Motor Vehicles. There was an accident late last month where a driver with a trailer hit and killed 7 motorcyclists in New Hampshire. And now that officials have gone in to take a look at the Registry of Motor Vehicles here in Massachusetts, they've found a lot of problems. Can you tell us about that?
Essentially, Catherine, the RMV wasn't reading its mail. And it's a light way to put a very serious thing. 7 motorcyclists died in this accident in New Hampshire that was allegedly caused by a driver who should have had his commercial driver's license and his regular driver's license revoked because of DUI charges and arrest in Connecticut. Now, that Connecticut sent notification to Massachusetts, the way the system is supposed to work is that you get the notice from the other state and then you suspend the driver's license. You notify them that their license is suspended because of, you know, a drunk driving arrest in this case. That never happened. What was found at the RMV was over 50 bins full of mail from other states, notifications, documents from other states that were either not opened or at least not processed. There is an electronic system as well that is the primary function of this system. In this instance, that was flawed. They're correcting the code of that electronic system. The backup paper system was essentially ignored. This caused RMV Registrar Aaron Devaney to resign. Last week, Governor Baker and Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack are now launching a pretty soup-to-nuts review of the RMV process, how this happened, how long it's been going on. Right off the bat, initial reports say that this mail had been stored in these bins at least since March 2018. So that is an awfully long time to be ignoring some very critical information. And, you know, there will be an audit by an outside firm to see, you know, how many drivers are affected. Already, there have been something like over 600 new license suspensions due to the discovery of this new information. So those are people taken off the road that should have been, that the state didn't until this, you know, this tragedy led to this review.
Now, you mentioned that Baker and Stephanie Pollack are going to conduct an investigation. What are lawmakers saying about this in response? I mean, this doesn't necessarily reflect well on the Baker administration. There's been a lot of frustration with the MBTA, and now this kind of bombshell news that the RMV had a lot of dysfunction.
Right. It depends really who you talk to. I spoke with Senate President Karen Spilka and House Speaker Robert DeLeo on Monday, and they really wanted to wait for this review and this audit, this investigation to run its course so that they could then act. I think it's likely that the legislature will hold some kind of oversight hearing or review to hear from these folks, you know, what happened. But like always, Democratic leaders really do still have an awful lot of faith in Governor Baker to manage his administration. And I spoke to a few folks. It's really only the far left, you know, progressive Democrats who will challenge Baker and say that he's not the administrator everyone thinks he is, and that his track record on things, especially transportation, when we talk about the T, when we talk about the RMV now, it is not as sterling as Baker would like people to think. But Democratic leaders have certainly done very little to challenge Baker on this. When that report comes out, however, and we have the information in front of us, that story may change.
And that is WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking to us from the rather quiet halls on Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
And that is WCAI's Catherine Iden talking with our State House reporter Mike Dean. Joining us now in the studio is WCAI reporter Eve Zuckoff. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning, Steve.
Eve, you had a fun story to cover this week. A very difficult assignment. It involved a very large turtle getting released back to the sea after months of rehab. Tell us about the turtle.
Yes. So you're talking about Munchkin. This is a 340-ish pound adult loggerhead sea turtle. She's just beautiful. I mean, this beautiful green shell, pink and orange skin. The official age is somewhere between the ages of in her 20s to 80.
Between 20 and 80.
Yes, we don't actually know. There's no way to age a live adult sea turtle. We just know that she's of reproductive age. And she was pretty unbelievable, especially considering 7 months ago she was discovered on Great Neck Beach in Wellfleet, covered in barnacles, essentially near death.
She was one of the turtles that came ashore as they do kind of in the fall, and they're cold, stunned, and they're in need of immediate care to survive.
Yes. Official diagnosis as cold stun, but she also was suffering from really serious injuries. Half of her front and back flipper were gone, probably injuries from entanglement. She was anemic. She was starving at 301 pounds, severely underweight, anemic from, blood loss. She was in really rough shape.
And this is a loggerhead turtle. Loggerheads are they're particularly unusual around here.
They are. I mean, they kind of are in waters all around the world, but they're endangered, so that's part of it. Loggerhead sea turtles have been endangered since 1978, so especially to find her when she did. I mean, the volunteer who found her is this guy named Tom Sullivan. He's from Wellfleet. He was volunteering with the Mass Audubon Sanctuary, and he thought she was a boulder when he first saw her until he saw bubbles kind of coming out from under her. But definitely unusual to see them in the waters at this time. It's too cold.
This week, Munchkin was, they're going to release her after this lengthy rehab, 7 months. Explain, what was the scene on West Dennis Beach when you got there?
It was buzzing. I mean, I got there and there were somewhere between 100, 200 volunteers just kind of crowding on the beach. I mean, the truck with her in it hadn't even gotten there yet. You know, it was about 20 minutes away and hundreds of people, young, old, children, kind of just trying to understand, you know, a little bored at first, but it really picked up and it was so intense though when she actually got there, because there was a team of, you know, 15, 20 biologists and volunteers from the New England Aquarium who had a really important job to do getting her onto the beach. And then, you know, the moment they did, everyone was clamoring to get a look at her because she was, you know, she was the star. She's the star of the day.
So they get this immense 340-pound loggerhead turtle. Kind of they hoist her out of the truck and they set her down on the sand up the slope. Over the water, kind of. And then tell us what happened.
Yeah. And I mean, to be clear, it took 15 people to get her onto a tarp. She was anxious to get out. I mean, it was a very tense scene watching them get her onto the sand on this tarp. But the moment she got down onto the sand, I mean, she took off. It was the fastest turtle I've ever seen in my life. She flew down the beach towards the water. And Adam Kennedy is a biologist for the New England Aquarium. He was kind of narrating her travels. And right when she got to the shoreline, she just paused. And not to anthropomorphize, not to romanticize too much, but it was just kind of this beautiful moment where I think everyone, there were some people who were like, uh-oh, does she know what to do? And I think there were other people who were kind of, you know, some of the volunteers watching her who had gotten to know her over the last 7 months were like, you know, having her pause for a moment. And Adam described it as, you know, she's just getting reacquainted. She's sniffing that sea air. And then she dove under and you know, everybody said, bye, Munchkin, safe travels. And it was lovely.
Now they have a tracker on her, cemented to her shell. They can tell where she is.
They can. And right now she is just south of Muskeget. You can actually follow her journey if you go to the New England Aquarium's website and type in Munchkin's journey. You can track her live. So in the next phase of her release is really starting with these data scientists and biologists. They're going to really be looking for, over the next year, they can track her. Where does she go? Will she reproduce, especially because they're endangered, because she's of reproductive age? It's a really important turtle. And that's really the next phase here.
Real quickly here, I want to introduce you formally as our environmental reporter. You started June 1st. Tell us a little bit about your focus, what folks can look forward to hearing from you on the air.
Yes. So the big thing with me, I think, is I'm going to try to focus in the next year on the intersection between people, you know, our communities, our homes, our schools, our businesses, our ideas, and climate change. What are the human impacts of climate change? What do we contribute to it, and how do we feel it? And I'm so excited because I think there's no greater place to do that than Cape Cod. I mean, we're the epicenter of research and innovation and ideas, while also being at the epicenter of feeling the impacts of climate change and coastal erosion. So this is the place to do it. So, yeah.
Great. We're so glad to have you. Listeners can look forward to hearing those stories throughout the year coming up. That's Eve Zukoff, CAI's own environmental reporter. Thanks for coming in this morning, Eve.
Thank you so much, Steve.
And I want to say thanks to all our other contributors this morning. We heard from Kristen Young at the Cape Cod Times, Holly Pretzky at the Vineyard Gazette, spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, checked in with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. That's our news roundup for the week. I'm Steve Junker. I want to thank you for listening.